Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone, where there's always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'm here to introduce this episode. And I know you've been waiting on the edge of your seat all week for this episode to drop, because it's the second part of Greg Prince's article, Where Do We Go From Here? Thoughts After 75 Years. So last week, in the first part, Greg talked about growing up LDS in Southern California and where he thinks the church has made some wrong turns. Today's episode covers what Greg feels the church has done right and how he thinks it can change to meet the challenges of today. So if you thought last week's episode was interesting, it's about to get a lot better. So let's dive in. 3. What has the church done right? A more humane Sunday schedule. Some changes have been instituted that appear to be important steps forward. One is the 2-hour Sunday meeting schedule, which was talked about and piloted for more than 4 decades before finally being implemented. Life immediately became easier for young children who had a difficult time with a 3-hour schedule, to say nothing of their parents and teachers. A nod towards women. Another is changes in the temple endowment ceremony, begun in earnest in the early 1990s, that have removed much of the misogynistic content that earlier had been offensive to many women, particularly the younger ones, and much of the remnant of Freemasonry that made sense when incorporated into the Nauvoo endowment ceremony in 1842, but became increasingly foreign and embarrassing to subsequent generations. Consolidation of the Melchizedek priesthood. The combining of all Melchizedek priesthood men within wards into a single quorum is a promising step. It was perhaps an unanticipated effect of Spencer Kimball's decision in the mid-1970s to reconstitute the First Quorum of 70 as a general office, and, simultaneously, abolish the office of 70 at the local level. Prior to that time, there had been well-defined distinctions between the 3 Melchizedek priesthood groups operating at the ward level. The elders largely watched over the members and, in too many cases, gave free moving services to incoming and outgoing ward members. The 70s engaged in missionary work, and the high priests held offices of presiding as members of bishoprics, high councils, and stake presidencies. When all local 70s were ordained high priests, the distinctions of both groups vanished. Perhaps responding to the perpetual dilemma that the main problems in a congregation are among the younger individuals and families, while the main repository of experience and wisdom resides among high priests, more than 4 decades after the change in the 70s, the 3 groups were combined into one, the Elders' Quorum. A more inclusive missionary program. When I was a missionary in Brazil, 1967 to 1969, we had only 2 missionaries in our entire mission, about 180 missionaries, who were Latin Americans, one from Brazil and one from Uruguay, and only 4 female missionaries. Gradually, as the church matured in many foreign countries, more non-American missionaries were called, along with more non-American mission presidents and local leaders. The reduction in age requirement for men and women, from 19 to 18 years for men and from 21 to 19 years for women, was a major step forward that resulted in a greatly increased representation of women in the missionary force. Gospel Topics Essays. The Gospel Topics Essays, 13 in all, while generally presenting the reader with a half-full cup, are nevertheless a significant step forward in allowing church members to own their religion. The essay on Blacks in the Priesthood, while not perfect, is a major step forward. It acknowledges openly that the exclusionary policy was implemented by Brigham Young in a time of intense racism in the country, and not by Joseph Smith, or, by inference, God. The essay on the Book of Abraham perhaps represents the most significant step into the scientific age by acknowledging the Book of Abraham not to be a translation of ancient papyri, and by advancing a sound explanation embodied in the Jewish concept of Midrash, where the inspired interaction between the scribe and a text results in the writing of another text that does not pretend to be a retranslation. This significant step forward was necessitated by modern translations of the papyri Joseph Smith purchased in 1835 that showed them to be funerary texts, what one would suppose would be buried with a mummy. The absence of gold plates forestalls a similar reckoning for the Book of Mormon, but an allegorical Book of Mormon, in the words of a non-LDS friend who was a professor of Hebrew Bible, quote, a book-length midrash on the King James Bible, unquote, is well within sight. Genealogy, a gift to the world. While Mormonism and genealogy are joined to the hip, such was not always the case. Shortly after the Salt Lake Temple was completed in 1893, 40 years after construction began, Church President Wilford Woodruff announced a change in doctrine. Whereas in earlier years, one could only be sealed to living relatives, Woodruff now directed church members to research their ancestry with a goal of linking each generation to its antecedent generation in an unbroken chain. Out of the new doctrine came a new organization, the Genealogical Society of Utah, founded the same year. Over the following century, the church pursued genealogy like no other organization in history. Microfilm crews traveled the globe, filming records of churches and governments pro bono in return for being able to archive a copy for genealogical research. Branch genealogical libraries were established, generally in existing church buildings, and the public were invited to utilize the church's database, with no strings attached. As digitization replaced analog filming, the church entered a new era of accessibility under the auspices of FamilySearch.org. Now, anyone in any part of the world can access the database from a personal computer at home, still with no strings attached. A gift to the world, and perhaps the greatest gift the church could give. Disaster relief. The church knows how to organize its members, particularly when disaster strikes. In addition to warehousing emergency supplies that it can deploy anywhere in the world within hours, the church can call upon its members on short notice to show up and give meaningful assistance to those in need. In the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, one of the most serious natural disasters in the United States in our lifetimes, a New Orleans resident, totally unaware of the irony of his comment, said, quote, "Only two groups showed up and stayed. The Mormons and the Latter-day Saints," unquote. Family preparedness. Out of the Great Depression came the realization that many families were a hair's breadth away from financial distress. The ascendancy of Harold B. Lee to the apostleship, and eventually church presidency, began when, as president of the Pioneer Stake, he initiated a program of self-sufficiency for members of his stake. He later became director of the Welfare Program, a church-wide initiative to help members move toward self-sufficiency. Although I was born well after the end of the Depression, 1948, I grew up in a church where there was continual emphasis on families having a year's supply of food, and, if possible, money. While increasing mobility of church members made the food supply problematic, a continuing emphasis, albeit more muted in recent years, on family preparedness continues to make good sense. 4. What is the way forward? Salt Lake One. In the early 1960s, Pope John XXIII convened the Second Ecumenical Council of the Vatican, commonly called Vatican II, with the stated purpose of the, quote, modernization of the church after 20 centuries of life, unquote. The council lasted for 4 years and resulted in major changes in the Roman Catholic Church. I believe the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints would benefit greatly from a similar council, one that would combine bottom-up and top-down. When one looks at the development of LDS structure, policy, and doctrine, it's apparent that there was no grand overarching blueprint from the beginning. In many ways, the ship was under construction well after it sailed. To those who believe it began as a perfect organization and never changed, I say that I have yet to see a significant doctrine of the church that has not undergone change since the church was founded in 1830. If we're to prepare the church for a brighter future, we should be willing to put everything about it on the table, and then make tough decisions about what will remain, what will be discarded, and what needs to be added. And to make those decisions with substantial input from the grassroots, the hierarchy, Red Chair Society, and the divine. To those who are repulsed by the concept of trickle-up revelation, I answer that all the auxiliary organizations of the church were the results of grassroots initiatives that were subsequently appropriated by the central church. I asked him. A group of medical students gathered for a tutorial in physical diagnosis. The professor told them that they were to go into an adjoining room, one at a time, perform a physical examination on a patient who was in that room, and then reassemble to discuss the case. After each student had done their examination, they reconvened. The professor went around the room, asking each for a diagnosis. All except the last student got it wrong. He said, "The patient has tertiary syphilis." The professor congratulated the student, pointing out that tertiary syphilis is often termed the great imitator, since many of its signs and symptoms appear identical to those of unrelated maladies. He said, "I presume you noticed this and this about the patient," to which the student said, "No." "How then did you make the diagnosis?" I asked him what he had. As simple as that story is, it is reflective of a common weakness within organizations of any kind or size. Management tends to be top-down. Sometimes progress can be made merely by asking people what they need. While I was in dental school at UCLA, I was called to be the regional president of the Latter-day Saints Student Association, a church-sponsored organization with chapters on college and university campuses with significant LDS student representation. In the summer of 1972, because of that calling, I was invited to a meeting with Thomas Monson, a member of the Quorum of 12 Apostles who later became church president. The meeting, which included 30 adult and young adult church leaders, was a fact-finding initiative on the part of Monson. For years, programs that focused on post-high school unmarried church members had become progressively less effective due to a changing paradigm. In the past, the expectation that drove curriculum was that marriage and family would come shortly after missionary service, with or without college education as a part of the package. Graduate school was uncommon. The new paradigm shifted to extended university education and delayed marriage, with the result that a growing population of single university students and university-aged professionals were increasingly left out of church programs. In response to the church-wide vacuum, local church leaders in Long Beach took the initiative to create a program they called Young Adults, which focused on this emerging demographic. They didn't ask permission of the church headquarters. They just did it. Almost immediately, good things began to happen. Our stake and others in the area quickly took note and implemented a similar program. It created enough buzz to get the attention of the central church. Hence, Monson's visit. The meeting consisted of each person in the room commenting on her or his experiences with the program, both good and bad. It was grassroots Mormonism at its finest. All bottom-up rather than the traditional top-down approach. At the end, Monson thanked everyone and returned to Salt Lake City. 3 weeks later, I was invited to another meeting on the same subject. This time, three upper-level bureaucrats from church headquarters attended and asked, again, that each person provide commentary. The three spoke only at the end, and then merely to ask clarifying questions while they took notes. Again, it was all bottom-up. The parting comment following both meetings was, "Keep doing what you're doing, as long as you're meeting people's needs." 1 year later, the church rolled out a new program called Young Adults, essentially a duplicate of what we had pioneered in Southern California, even using the same name. Several years thereafter, as I began research on my book on priesthood history, I learned that virtually all the programs that had shaped my church experience had been of a similar nature. That is, local members saw a need and addressed it, whereupon general officers, upon seeing successful initiatives, instituted them churchwide. Most of those initiatives occurred in the 19th century, but several in the 20th, young adults was in good company. I call it Trickle-Up Revelation, a play on the Ronald Reagan administration's trickle-down economics, except only one of the two worked. Unfortunately, the correlation movement that was gaining steam at the time intentionally cut off trickle-up, arrogantly assuming the good ideas could only come from the top. We're a much poorer church as a result. Nonetheless, the young adult experience instilled in me a lasting appreciation that good ideas could trickle upward, even penetrating a rigid bureaucracy imbued with a not-invented-here aversion to outside influence. More important for me was understanding that my religious tradition, and likely all others, could not lay claim to a passive mode of revelation, with men sitting in a sacred space waiting for God to deliver it pre-packaged. Address faith crisis issues directly. I had never heard of the Mountain Meadows Massacre until I went to Dixie College, now Utah Tech University, and was a next-door neighbor to Juanita Brooks. She, in turn, had never heard of it until one of the last survivors of the mob that carried out the massacre, Nephi Johnson, died in delirium in her presence. His last words being, "Blood, blood." That encounter started her on a 3-decade journey to tell the truth about what was the largest incident of white-on-white mass murder in the country's history, until the Oklahoma City bombing by Timothy McVeigh more than a century later. As pivotal as Brooks' 1950 book, The Mountain Meadows Massacre, was, it didn't tell the whole story, for the church had denied her access to some of the most important documentary materials relating to it. And so, the ghosts of the massacre continued to haunt the church. Shortly after the turn of the 21st century, Rick Turley, an employee of the church history department, approached church president Gordon B. Hinckley and made an audacious request to write a new book that would tell the whole story. Only then, Turley suggested, would the ghosts be exorcised once and for all. Hinckley agreed. The church opened its archives to the three co-authors and provided substantial funding for the project, and in 2008, The Massacre at Mountain Meadows was published. A no-holds-barred narrative, it closed a dark chapter of the church's history, just as Turley had predicted. The issues at the top of our list in our 2001 Faith Crisis Survey are modern-day correlates of the Mountain Meadows Massacre, in that each haunts church members with inquiring minds and will continue to do so until it receives the same kind of treatment. On some, substantial progress has been made, particularly, as noted earlier, the Book of Abraham. However, the big one, the Book of Mormon, remains mostly unaddressed by the church. I sympathize with the plight of the church because its narrative since the book was published nearly 200 years ago has been that the people of the Americas and Oceania are literal descendants of the children of Israel, and thus a chosen people. If the church moves from the model of an ancient Book of Mormon to an allegorical one, what becomes of the chosen lineage, and what becomes of the millions of converts in Latin America and the Pacific Islands whose allegiance to the church was predicated on an ancient book and literal kinship with the House of Israel? The essential question is not if the church addresses the historicity of the Book of Mormon, but when. The continual accumulation of scientific evidence for a 19th century Book of Mormon makes unavoidable the eventual confrontation. In the heavens, is everyone straight? The central reason Boyd Packer and other general church officers refused to acknowledge the biological paradigm for non-heterosexuality, "you were not born that way," is likely the fact that current LDS afterlife theology has no room for gay. And if gay is not a possibility there, then it can't be an inborn trait here. However, this rationale ignores two realities. The first is that there is rapidly mounting scientific evidence that nearly all flavors of non-heterosexuality have a biological basis, born that way, and probably different biological bases for different flavors. The second is that during Joseph Smith's ministry, LDS afterlife theology changed frequently, and sometimes drastically. This leaves open the crucial question, is LDS afterlife theology set in stone? Or do we yet await further enlightenment that may address not only the issue of homosexuality, but also of all the other flavors of non-heterosexuality? The Sabbath was made for man. When Pharisees sought to entrap Jesus in the Mosaic Law for having healed on the Sabbath, his response was, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." I believe the same philosophy should dictate the role of the church. In other words, the church is made for the members, not the members for the church. Mormonism has drifted into the latter philosophy, and we suffer because of that. We need to reverse the trend. The church will do just fine if it directs its efforts to helping its members. The most enjoyable and rich interview of the 800-plus I have recorded was with Rabbi Harold Kushner, who was best known as the author of the book When Bad Things Happen to Good People. He addressed the same issue, albeit not from a Christian perspective. Quote, "I grew up in a very strong, very active congregation in Brooklyn, and I adored and idolized my rabbi. He was a wonderful preacher. To this day, every time I sit down to write a sermon, I feel him looking over my shoulder and making sure I'm being authentic. He was considered one of the best preachers in the country. But when I think back to those sermons, they were all about what we had to do to make Judaism stronger. My sermons are all about what Judaism can do to make your life better. I think it's in those terms that we have to speak to the younger generation. Give me a better idea of where the shoe pinches. What bothers you about life? Is it your sense of insignificance? Is it your sense of the indestructibility of evil? Is it your discomfort with parts of yourself that you're embarrassed by? What's your spiritual agenda, and let me see if there's anything in my armamentarium that can be helpful to you." Unquote. We would do better if we met people where they are and helped them to a better place, rather than trying to fit everyone into a mold that, for many, will never work. Let's ask where the shoe pinches, and then work with them to alleviate the pain. Restore the mystery of God. Arnold Freeberg came to fame in the mid-1950s by painting actors and scenes from Cecil B. DeMille's classic movie, The Ten Commandments, for which he was nominated for an Academy Award. Later, as official artist of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, he painted many scenes glorifying the proud tradition of the Mounties. Arguably Freeberg's most famous painting, and one that, in the aftermath of his death, likely is moving his legacy from illustrator to artist, was commissioned by American Heritage magazine for the U.S. Bicentennial. A large painting, it depicts George Washington at Valley Forge, kneeling in prayer in the snow beside his horse. So many replicas of this painting have been sold that it has become an American art icon. Predating all these works, however, and unknown to most non-Latter-day Saints, are 12 paintings depicting scenes in the Book of Mormon. Dating to the early 1950s, they were commissioned privately and paid for by an LDS woman who was leader of the Children's Auxiliary Organization of the Church, the Primary. She hoped that they would draw children into the stories of the book. Although she didn't live long enough to see any of the finished paintings, her hope was realized to an extent she likely would not have expected, as for many decades the church included full-color reproductions in millions of copies of the Book of Mormon. Although the paintings were not commissioned or paid for by the church, Freeberg had, quote, "endless, endless discussions," unquote, with church leaders over their content. At one point, church president David O. McKay said to him, "Now whatever you do, don't paint Christ into the Book of Mormon." Freeberg replied, "That's the high point of the book. Why not?" Indeed, years after McKay's death, attempting to convince others that the Mormons were Christians, church leaders added a subtitle to the book's cover, Another Testament of Jesus Christ. But that was later. McKay's response was disarming and, to me, haunting to this day. Quote, "Oh, the finite cannot conceive of the infinite," unquote. Today, one can hardly walk the hallways of an LDS chapel without seeing artistic images of Jesus, who seems to become fairer in skin, hair, and eye color with passing decades. And yet, I get McKay's point, and wish we had been able to maintain a respectful and awesome, filled with awe, distance between the finite and the infinite. The process by which Latter-day Saint theology closed that distance began with Joseph Smith, who, near the end of his ministry and his life, taught that God had once been human, as we now are, and that we have the potential to become as God is. One need only consult a dictionary definition of blasphemy to see why many non-Mormons use the word in describing Mormonism. Over many decades, church members have leaned on that teaching to trivialize the nature of God and shorten the distance between God and us. Perhaps in response to repeated charges of blasphemy, the late church president Gordon B. Hinckley publicly distanced the church from teachings that God was once a man and that we may become gods. In an interview with Time magazine in 1997, responding to the question of whether God the Father was once a man like we are, he said, quote, "I don't know that we teach it. I don't know that we emphasize it. I haven't heard it discussed for a long time in public discourse," unquote. The same year, Hinckley sidestepped the question of humans becoming gods by saying, quote, "We believe that the glory of God is intelligence, and whatever principle of intelligence we attain to in this life, it will rise with us in the resurrection. Knowledge, learning, is an eternal thing. And for that reason, we stress education," unquote. The more that I've interacted with other religionists, particularly Christians and Jews, the more I yearn for that more distant God, whose infinitude remains a benevolent mystery. To stand in awe of such a God and remove one's shoes when standing on holy ground is, to me, both an expression of humility and an acknowledgement of reality. Quote, "My thoughts are not your thoughts," unquote, the prophet Amos wrote of God, and we Latter-day Saints would do well to bow more deeply before the infinite God we worship. When ye are in the service. For nearly two centuries, the Church has responded to the injunction, teach, preach, and baptize, through standard proselytizing approaches, which often means knocking on doors on which generations of missionaries have already knocked, and with diminishing returns. There is another approach to missionary outreach, one that I believe would energize the entire church, expand the missionary pool dramatically, lead to durable conversions rather than the revolving door converts of recent years, and, if pursued symmetrically, change the world. That approach? Service missions. Such missions already exist, but they are almost exclusively for retired couples or for young missionaries who, for physical or psychological reasons, are not able to serve proselytizing missions. Thus, service missions are viewed by many as of less value than proselytizing missions. I believe it is time to revamp the entire missionary system and offer service missions to all. A service mission is not a novel concept. I was made aware of it for the first time in 1997, when Paul Dunn and his wife Jean were our house guests in Maryland. While there, Paul called one of his former missionaries. He served as a president of the New England States Mission from 1968 to 1971, Dennis Webb, who was the president of the Richmond, Virginia Mission. Webb had friends in high places, most notably Elder Neil Maxwell of the Quorum of Twelve, to whom he successfully pitched the idea of having all missionaries in his mission do full-time service missions. I listened in on the conversation and was deeply impressed with the results the mission was experiencing. However, Despite promising results, the pilot program in the Richmond mission was discontinued as soon as Webb completed his term as mission president, and the missionary program reverted to its old ways. In the years since then, we've seen diminishing returns on missionary outreach through the traditional approach of proselytizing. I believe it is time to try a radically different approach that would employ all missionaries, regardless of age, in full-time service. Nearly all aspects of our missiology would need to be rethought and retooled. Perhaps the most important would be that mission presidents would be called based on their ability to manage sustained service programs. Periodic weeding of the yards of widows would not work. Missionaries likely would be assigned to projects for prolonged periods of time, much longer than the 3 months of a typical transfer in the current system. Service projects would have durations of months or years, or in many cases, indefinite time. But if well planned, and if stuck to, such projects could change communities and the world. Near the end of the Obama administration, Paul Monteiro, whom I had known while he worked in the White House, became National Director of AmeriCorps Vista, the domestic counterpart to the Peace Corps. I arranged for a meeting in his office with the LDS couple called to oversee the church's very successful Just Serve program. The three quickly saw a hand-in-glove relationship between the church's potential legions of volunteers and Vista's carefully curated list of worthy service projects throughout the country. All that remains is buy-in from the church. A big if, but with the potential of changing the church and the world around it, particularly if the church loosens the strings on its purse containing $160 billion to fund some of the projects. Something Great in 78. An earlier section described the many things about the church in earlier years that instilled a sense of community, something often called the Ward family. Nearly all of those are gone, but it still is possible to rekindle the Ward family. I saw one innovative approach not long after my wife and I moved to Maryland in the mid-1970s. Chevy Chase Ward, which was in our stake, embarked on an initiative to encourage its members to put into practice what then-President Spencer Kimball had often preached, lengthen your stride. Entirely voluntary, the program encouraged members to set an ambitious goal for themselves, and then to allow the ward to bundle all the goals into a year-long effort with the catchy name, Something Great in 78. For some, the goal was to catch up on family history. For others, it was to continue their higher education. And for yet others, it was to write a book. The results were impressive, and the sense of community within the ward skyrocketed. Why not encourage all wards to be creative in recapturing the reality of the ward family? Ministry to those with disabilities. Our 33-year-old son Madison is severely autistic. We used to be able to take him to church, but as he passed through adolescence, he was no longer able to tolerate sitting in any meeting. Not once has a local church official, quorum leader, bishop, stake president, approached us and asked us to inform him about autism in general, and Madison in particular. Others in the church who have loved ones with disabilities are equally frustrated as they try to navigate together what Rabbi Harold Kushner called this frightening cosmos. The church may not have long-term solutions, and certainly it has no satisfying answers as to the why of disabilities, but even an occasional gesture of compassion and empathy would lighten the load of those families. Take a place at the table. Many years ago, I went golfing with the president of Wesley Theological Seminary. My hope for the outing was just for us to get to know each other, but on the third tee, the president, David McAllister Wilson, said, "So tell me about Mormonism." For the final 15 holes, that was the topic of our conversation. When we returned to the clubhouse for lunch, David said, "You Mormons have a good religion. You should be at the table." My response, "David, we have yet to acknowledge that there is a table." By degrees, he invited me to the seminary's table, culminating in an invitation to join its Board of Governors in 2017, the first time in the 143-year history of the seminary that a Latter-day Saint held that position. The first thing I learned upon joining the board was that a simple gesture of self-criticism on my part diffused any hesitancy board members might have had to welcome me with open arms. The second was that I was in constant awe of their acting out of their faith. Usually I felt inadequate by comparison. I still do, although I embrace the Wesley community as my second spiritual home. My presence at Wesley has allowed me to facilitate several connections between it and the LDS Church, generally without the church being aware of the process. One of the highlights was a 2009 meeting between David and the First Presidency in Salt Lake City. There is so much we could do if we could turn our insularity inside out and take our place among other faith traditions. The existential challenges facing our world are solvable, but only if people of all faith traditions, and even faithless people who possess personal integrity, stand shoulder to shoulder with each other and act in concert. Holy Envy. Theologian Christer Stendahl, Emeritus Bishop of Stockholm and former head of the Harvard Divinity School, coined the term holy envy. It's the feeling I have toward other faith traditions that are doing a better job than we are at emulating God's will on earth. Let me give you a recent example that occurred in North Carolina. We have a vacation home in Kitty Hawk, and when we're there on Sundays, we often attend a United Methodist church. Before attending Kitty Hawk UMC, I went on its website and was blown away by how this modest congregation walks the walk of Christianity. In addition to Sunday worship services, it participates in the following outreach activities: care ministry, providing home-cooked meals, calls, and cards to the ill; beach food pantry, staffing the local food pantry 1 week each month using volunteers from the congregation; local, national, and international mission trips; ongoing assistance to congregants with family members who are incarcerated; room at the inn. In collaboration with other congregations in the community, Kitty Hawk UMC opens its facilities for 1 week to provide shelter and food for homeless people during the winter months. It offers a warm, safe place to sleep and serves 3 meals a day. A greater goal is to provide a more personal relationship to homeless people and a deeper understanding of the depth and complexity of the issue and show them God's love. Walk to Emmaus, a 3-day retreat that focuses on, quote, the theme of God's grace, how that grace comes alive in the Christian community, and how it is expressed in the world, unquote. Food for thought. Through partnerships with local schools, businesses, and other community groups, the Kids Pack program provides homeless and very low-income school children with backpacks filled with nutritious foods each weekend, when school meals are not available. The goal of the Kids Pack program is to ensure that food insecure and hungry children have food during the weekends so that they are able to engage in school and succeed. Bible studies, weekday instruction open to the community. Stephen ministry. A Stephen minister is a well-trained caregiver who listens, cares, prays, encourages, and offers the love of Christ during a time of need. Kitty Hawk UMC currently has 14 well-trained lay caregivers who provide Christ-centered care for grief, divorce, major illness, loneliness, financial stress, and other life difficulties. Intercessory prayer team. Wednesday night free meal that is open to the community. When I compare this to the insularity of LDS congregations, my heart aches. Why can't we turn our congregations inside out and join with other faiths in these expressions of unconditional love? Invigorate worship services. Boredom is not good for anyone, but it is particularly dangerous for youth. Their attention spans are short, and competing voices are legion. We can't merely display a banner saying, "Truth!" and expect to hold on to the youth. Our sacrament meetings are routinely boring, but they don't need to be so. Why not add more music, more content directed to children and youth? why not return to a little-known custom of the 19th century church known as home missionaries? These were generally drawn from returned missionaries and were selected for having outstanding rhetorical skills. They would rotate among wards in a stake and be major speakers in sacrament meetings. We often extol the virtues of not having a trained ministry, but the price we pay is boredom when people with no training and no rhetorical skills occupy the pulpit. While we're at it, why not offer classes in public speaking, like the classes we used to offer in teacher training? Put church history back into the curriculum. More so than virtually any other religious tradition, Mormonism is its history. And yet, focused classes on church history have not been part of the adult curriculum in over half a century. Converts and young lifers have little understanding of our history, and we pay a price for their ignorance. Saints, the multi-volume history of the church, is a ready-made, multi-year course of study, but even more compelling, in my experience, are the countless unpublished narratives within 19th century ward records that tell the real story of the church. The story of mostly anonymous saints in the trenches who managed to live their religion in the face of what were often overwhelming challenges. A far cry from the great men, great events narratives that characterized earlier tellings of church history, these represent the glue that held the church together, and they're a touchstone for current members who are also just trying to make it work. Encourage thoughtful inquiry. If we really believe that the glory of God is intelligence, let's reverse the trend of anti-intellectualism that pervades much of the church. Rather than cast aspersions on science, which church leaders recently have done, acknowledge the power of the scientific method in discovering and embracing truth. Create venues for open discussion, whether in church buildings or homes. The kinds of venues of which Washington Post reporter Michelle Boorstein spoke, which are the lifeblood of Judaism. If we are what we say we are, we have nothing to fear from full disclosure. Reclaim moral authority in the public square. We live in an era where one political party has embraced alternative facts, which are nothing more than untruths. Rather than condemn the ills that accompany such a political philosophy, religious persecution, particularly of non-Christian traditions, racism, lying, hatred, bullying, toxic political polarization, religious traditions across the spectrum have retreated to the sidelines, apparently fearful of speaking in the prophetic voice that calls people to a higher level of living. There is a vacuum of moral authority that needs to be filled, and the Latter-day Saints need to step forward and begin to fill it. Give women a voice. There is no scriptural ban on women serving in governing councils with the same voice as men. Priesthood ordination is not the issue here. Voice is. Why should women be deprived of equal input into deciding who is called to positions? Why should their counsel not be sought and followed in disciplinary councils? We have made progress in retooling temple ceremonies to be less demeaning of the role of women, but there is still much work to be done. Implement emeritus status for all general authorities. Enough said already. For 2 years, from 2005 to 2007, I worked behind the scenes with PBS producer Helen Whitney as she prepared a 4-hour documentary titled, simply, The Mormons. As the film was moving to its final stages of production, Helen called me and said, "I've interviewed hundreds of members of your church. You have a good religion, but most of your people borrow it. They need to own it." I had not thought in these terms. In the intervening years, I've come to appreciate how true Helen's words were and are. You don't own Mormonism merely by showing up, any more than you become a true Christian merely by wearing the name of Jesus on your sleeve. A year after the 1978 revelation that changed the church forever, President Spencer Kimball delivered a message in General Conference that penetrated me to the core, and that still resonates with me. It remains a call to all church members, and an endorsement of the power of trickle-up revelation. Quote, "Now, my brothers and sisters, it seems clear to me, indeed, this impression weighs upon me, that the church is at a point in its growth and maturity when we are at last ready to move forward in a major way. Some decisions have been made, and others pending, which will clear the way organizationally. But the basic decisions needed for us to move forward as a people must be made by individual members of the church. The major strides which must be made by the church will follow upon the major strides to be made by us as individuals. We have paused on some plateaus long enough. Let us resume our journey forward and upward." Unquote. Well, thanks for joining me for this episode of the Sunstone Podcast. I hope that article did as many things to your brain as it did to mine. I've been thinking about it a lot over the past few months. And remember to send your presentation or panel proposals to us for this year's Summer Symposium, which will take place the first weekend of August at the University of Utah. And while you're there, stop by the Sunstone Review to see the new stuff we have posted there. It's always an eclectic place. All right then, I'll talk with you again next episode.